occasionally I do say things, I'm sure, that flummox the audience. I'm quite aware of that, but I'm not sure it can be avoided, really. I mean, I've taken to saying soccer much more than football now if I'm talking to the American audience. And going back to 1994, I said 20 minutes gone, it's still 0-0 here. And the producer said into my headphones, don't you mean 0-0?
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer, as always, is Bette Marston. And in this podcast, which comes out weekly, we interview members of the sports media about their work and interesting people about the sports media. Last week's podcast with ESPN commentator Bomani Jones, the feedback was fantastic. Thank you so much for all your comments. You can tweet me at Richard Deitch on Twitter, RichardDeitsch, and give me any kind of feedback, criticism, guest suggestion, or otherwise. But we welcome that for this podcast, and thank you very much for supporting it. The numbers have been great, better than we expected, and we'll try to keep giving you really good guests. This week in particular, we think we have a great guest. It is the ESPN soccer commentator, Ian Dark. Ian Dark joined ESPN in September 2010 as that network's lead soccer voice in the United States. That's after a long career at Sky Sports in the UK, where he called Premier League soccer and boxing. Ian also has worked for the BBC. I don't really have to tell you this guy if you follow sports broadcast. He's one of the most accomplished soccer voices in the history of the medium, has called multiple World Cups, including the 2014 World Cup in Brazil for ESPN, called the 2011 FIFA Women's World Cup in Germany for ESPN. He will be calling Premier League games for BT. He'll be calling U.S. national team games for ESPN, and he will be the voice of the European Championships for ESPN when that tournament comes up. But he has agreed, very nice of him, to join us fresh from his Spanish vacation. And I now believe he is back in the south of London at his home. So without further ado, let's bring on Ian Dark of ESPN. Okay, as promised, from his home in the south of London, or south of London, we bring on the ESPN soccer commentator, Ian Dark, who I believe is fresh off coming back from Spain. Am I correct, Ian?
Yeah, that's right, Richard. We've been on vacation, got an apartment on a golf course, not too far from Marbella, if anybody knows that, on the south coast of Spain. But it is way, way too hot down there. We didn't get out to play too much golf in those kind of conditions, but very relaxing before the very, very busy season ahead.
Am I correct, Ian, in that a lot of the soccer broadcasting community goes to Spain on holiday in July, early August?
Yeah, that would be right. Quite often down there, there's a quite a sort of a jet-setty type place with millionaires' yachts called Porto Banús. And you'll often see some of the players in the brief off-season that they have hanging around down that kind of area. Because it's a place to be seen a little bit. I think Roman Abramovich's yacht is sometimes to be found moored there, and I think Frank Lampard in his Chelsea days once was given a vacation on board that yacht with his lady of the time.
That sounds like a place that both Taylor Twellman and Alexi Lalas would really enjoy, Ian.
Well, I think they would. I think anybody probably would. It, frankly, for me, it's a little bit pretentious there. But it's one of those places where there's a lot of people thronging around and walking around the harbor area. And these people in hugely expensive cars try to drive through just so that you can see that they are driving some wonderful car like a Lamborghini.
I love that. And it's quite a contrast from the crowded number one subway that I took today, temperature only 130 degrees inside. So
you have my sincere sympathies. I love New York, but it can get hot this time of year.
Yes, it can. All right, we will move on to what is the what this podcast is about, and that is process and how our guests do their job, what they think of things in the sports media. Incredibly delighted to have Ian, and I think he'll provide great insight as Rachel Nichols and Adam Schefter and Bob Lee and the many other guests that we've had on this podcast have done. All right, so Ian, let's start off with this. This is one of the questions I wanted to ask you because I honestly don't know the answer. How often do you watch your work still? Do you still go over videos of your games and self-critique yourself?
I try to do that, Richard, probably once a month or so, to just watch back 20 minutes or so of commentary. And that's just to see, am I talking too much? Am I talking too little? Do I need to spice it up, color it up a little bit? You just do a little bit of self-analysis, and you hear sometimes one or two things that you don't like, and hopefully you hear one or two things that you do. But I think probably like most broadcasters, you end up being your own worst critic.
What, in terms of evaluation from your own managers and bosses at ESPN, do they, you know, I know at Fox for the NFL, they provide pretty detailed notes for their broadcasters after games. Do you, when you're doing either the U.S. national team or a European competition, do you receive notes from your bosses or even maybe a conference call about things that they thought went well, things that did not?
We tend to talk about what the broadcast is going to be and what it's trying to achieve in production terms before rather than after. I'm something of an opponent of turning everything into a huge planning ordeal every time and numerous production meetings. I think that can be counterproductive in the end when what we are doing is commentating on a live event, which is often quite hard to read or pre-choreograph. You can have ideas, but what is served up in front of you might be something completely different. As for reaction afterwards, it's nice if you get a little note from one of the bosses saying, great job last night. But I think, generally speaking, ESPN tend to be reasonably sparing with that. And I don't mind that at all, because I don't think we have to be patted on the back for doing our job every time we sit in front of a microphone.
Ian, how different a broadcaster are you when you're calling a game for an American audience versus a British audience?
I'm not any different at all, I'd like to think. I've been asked this one before, and maybe going back to 1994, when I commentated on the World Cup back then on ESPN, I think things were different then. There was a feeling that vast numbers of people who were watching didn't really understand the game fully, and you had to explain the offside law and that kind of thing, and the basics of the game. I think now it would be an insult to the audience in the United States. They're seeing a lot of soccer and have watched a lot of soccer over World Cups. It's grown enormously. So basically, I would do the same kind of job I would do in the United States as I would be doing in Europe.
What about phraseology, though, Ian? You know, there are expressions that, you know, they're just the lexicon is different in the UK than it is in America, just even as simple as, you know, elevator versus lift, sixes and sevens is an expression in the UK that we here in the States don't really know. So do you think subconsciously at all your language choices change depending on where you're broadcasting a game?
Well, I try to be reasonable when I'm doing this kind of thing, but let me give you a couple of examples of what you're talking about. I came out with the phrase after I think the USA had played well in the previous game, and in the next match, the performance was a bit flat. And I said, halfway through the first half, using an English phrase, which is, would be well known to English viewers, I said, this is a little bit like after the Lord Mayor show. Chris Alexopoulos, the producer, said into my headphones, what are you talking about? You explain that. What is the Lord Mayor show? So I had to explain on there. I said, what I mean by that is that it was a lot of hoopla and a great performance last time, and this one is a little bit flatter. It's a phrase we use in London quite a lot. But occasionally I do say things, I'm sure, that flummox the audience. I'm quite aware of that, but I'm not sure it can be avoided, really. I mean, I've taken to saying soccer much more than football now if I'm talking to the American audience. And going back to 1994, I said, 20 minutes gone, it's still nil-nil here. And the producer said into my headphones, don't you mean 0-0? There are things like that that crop up all the time. But hopefully, you'd like to think that generally it makes sense to people.
Has it reversed at all? Have you said any Americanized expressions while doing a game, let's say, in the UK?
Well, sometimes I've tweeted things, kind of thinking of people who might be following me on Twitter in the United States and have used the word soccer. And I've had people in England saying, you're getting very Americanized. What's all this about soccer? So you can't win.
That's funny. All right, let's talk about preparation. I know you've been asked this, but I want to get into your preparation for both how you prepare, let's say, for a U.S. national team game versus how you might prepare for a Premier League game versus how you might prepare for the World Cup and how they're different and how they're similar. So let's first start off with just doing games here in the States when the U.S. national team plays. From however many days prior to that assignment, what is your preparation like?
Well, actually, it's a bit of a round-the-clock type of thing, this. There are books that need to be kept up to date. I keep a record of every appearance and goal scorer for the United States since the Jürgen Klinsmann era started. So I can look back and I can see so-and-so has gone 23 games since he scored. Things like that, whether the audience find those lines interesting is another matter, whether you actually use them on air. But they're there in my book. I've got the results. I can see when they won away in Europe. You can spot patterns. You can see that Bedoya has appeared in the last, you know, there was a point where he'd appeared in about 16 games in a row. That kind of basic material I will have going all the time. Now, nearer the match, obviously, you have to not only prepare the U.S. team, and you're looking really for something a little bit different to say about players, up-to-date storylines about them, if you can pick them up. That's not always possible. So you'll maybe hang around the team hotel. You might talk to Michael Kammerman, the PR guy, and bounce a couple of things off him. He might be able to give you a line or two. I think we were told that Alejandro Bedoya's wife had just delivered a baby on the eve of one game. Things like that you can drop into the commentary. And we're lucky with the U.S. because normally on a match day, Jürgen Klinsmann will sit down with Taylor Twellman and myself at 10:30 in the morning, wherever the team hotel is, and he'll have a good chat with us. And on a confidential basis, if he's in the mood, he will even give us the team on a very, very confidential basis, not to be tweeted, not to be told to anybody else, simply to help us with our commentary. So that is an enormous help for which I'm very, very grateful. You'd never get to do that really with Jose Mourinho in the Premier League in England. And there are some managers you wouldn't even dare to dream of asking them what their lineup might be, even 90 minutes beforehand. Others are pretty helpful. I can ring up on the morning of the game and they'll say, yep, as long as you don't tell anyone, this will be the team. So that's a little bit of contacts that go along. But with the U.S., I must say, the help we get is first rate.
I have to ask, Ian, which EPL manager, either current or former, would be the most intimidating to call up to ask for the lineup in advance?
Well, I think I just said it. I think Jose Mourinho. I think last season I was standing beside him in the tunnel when Chelsea played at Hull, and he was just waiting around, and there were 90 minutes to kick off, and the team was due to be announced in 30 minutes anyway. It has to be announced with an hour to go. And I thought, well, shall I ask him the team? And then I thought, no, I'm not going to ask him because he's going to look at me as if I've just arrived from Mars, because he doesn't give anybody the lineup. I'm sure if he could, he'd announce it 5 minutes after the kickoff time.
He got to love Mourinho. In terms of your Premier League responsibilities this year, Ian, what will you be doing? Will you be calling games again in the UK?
Yeah, I have a contract to do Premier League matches for BT Sport in England. We don't have the lion's share of them. Sky Sports has most of the Premier League, but what we do have this season is the Champions League as well. So that's a big departure. and a massive new contract. So there'll be a lot of European travel this year.
Oh, that's really interesting. Is the you know, you discussed sort of how you keep a running book with the U.S. national team since the Klinsmann era. That's very interesting to me. You obviously have many, many years' experience in the Premier League. You obviously follow the Champions League just as a football fan. Is the preparation different for doing domestic stuff that you do in England and Champions League? And if so, how is the preparation for those games different?
Well, with the Premier League, as I told you, as with the US, I have kept for season after season after season a book of all the appearances and goal scorers going way back to when the Premier League started. So I can look back in old books and find the day that Paul Scholes made his debut for Manchester United and who that was against. That kind of information, it's all there, gathering cobwebs on my shelf at home. But occasionally I can pull out a little gem from there just from having those books. As you say, for the Champions League, there was a time when I covered that on quite a regular basis when I used to work for Sky Sports in England. Not so much in recent seasons, but I've been doing quite a lot this summer in spare time, just getting background information on what's been going on in the various European leagues with those teams. And of course, as a commentator, you watch the Champions League anyway, so many of the players are familiar, and it's going to be exciting to cover.
Ian, what do you, when there's a name on a team that's just untraditional or tough to pronounce, you know, somebody on Benfica who's from China or something to that effect, how do you go about? And let's say the mechanisms are not in case are not in place where there's a PR director the way there would be for the U.S. national team. How do you go about learning the proper and correct pronunciation of that player?
Well, there's a couple of routes with that. I mean, if you're somewhere like the World Cup or you're actually at the Champions League game, my first point of reference would be the journalists from that country who'd be hanging around in the media room, and you can help them as well with the pronunciation of English players or US players. So you can always do that, and I would run through and do that really as a matter of course, even on a USA game where, say, they were playing against Panama or Haiti or somebody like that. You'd try to seek out somebody close to the camp and say, can you just run through those names with me? And you get a phonetic and write them out phonetically so you've got a good idea. But I have been known in the past to even ring up embassies and say, can you help me, please? I'm covering your national football team tonight at Wembley. Can you please help me with the pronunciations of these players because the names look a little bit odd? So they're usually really, really pleased that you've called them and only too happy to help.
I love that. I'm glad to hear they're receptive. That's a very good broadcasting tip.
Not all of them, but nearly all of them, Richard.
Maybe hopefully democratic countries are at least receptive.
I rang the Bulgarian embassy in London, and I think the guy thought that I was completely crazy.
I need you to now one day ring a North Korean embassy somewhere, if they exist. You know, you've had many, many partners over the years, and obviously for the States, Taylor Twellman now has been a partner of yours for a couple of years. I think you guys have found terrific chemistry together. Is there something that an analyst must have or must do so that it works with you as part of a team?
I think the rules are pretty basic with that. I think that the analyst's job, and usually you're talking about somebody who's played at a pretty high level of the game, and I include Taylor in that, of course, who should have been in the US's World Cup squad. Everybody, I think, knows that in 2006 and was so unlucky. What you want them to tell you is something that only a top player can see out there, not something that the audience can see themselves. We know the shot went a foot wide because the replay's just shown you that. But you want the analyst to say, well, if he'd taken that chance a shade earlier with his left foot, he'd have had a chance of scoring there. That kind of thing is what you're looking for, insights that only top players can bring you. But the other thing, I think, that the key thing is sometimes you'll listen to a commentary with two people calling a match. And it sounds like they're not sitting together at all. They're sitting on opposite sides of the stadium because they're not interacting with each other. So I think that warmth is very much apparent, that there's a little bit of byplay, and just occasionally, without trying to turn it into a vaudeville act, people sitting at home might just smile at something that the two of you say to each other, a little joke. But I stress, you can overplay that, and it's always got to be about the match. It's not about the announcers.
How important is it to find off mic chemistry? You know, whether that's just going out to dinner in every city, and this sort of the follow up is, can you have a great broadcast partner if you don't like that broadcast partner away from the game?
I think it would be difficult if you really didn't get on and there was a clash of egos, or there were differing ideologies really about how you went about the job. But I can honestly say that nearly everybody I've commentated with, it's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with them. And I've been really impressed. I work in England with Michael Owen, the former England striker, and how willing he is to learn the new job of broadcasting. That's been true of Gary Neville too, who's become a big star analyst in the UK. And it's very true of Taylor Twellman as well, that he really does work at it. He doesn't think, oh, I know this game back to front, I don't need to do any prep. Taylor always arrives with a full book of notes on all the players, and he's usually on top of most of the stories too.
I did not know you were working with Michael Owen. What kind of potential do you see with him as a broadcaster?
Well, I think he's going to have a big media career now because he wants to. I think it keeps his adrenaline flowing. It replaces what he did as a player. He's now involved in the game. He's got his horse racing operation that he runs too, and that's very close to his heart as well. And occasionally he gives us the odd good tip too. In fact, a couple this week, but that's another story. But Michael's very keen to learn. He doesn't think he knows it all, and he's getting better all the time. And he has, particularly when it's an attacker who is involved in an incident, a game, some of his insights are quite brilliant. You often think, I'd have never thought of that. I can watch 1,000 games, you could watch 1,000 games, Richard, but you'd never know everything about the game that a top professional player would know.
One of the things, Ian, that's always fascinating to me is how fans and viewers view soccer broadcasters. And I have always found that football, soccer, television watchers are as critical, if not the most critical, of the broadcaster of the sport. Golf is up there too. And again, this is a country that has football and basketball, hockey, etc. But as someone who's a fan of the sport and someone who really pays attention to people's opinion on broadcasters, I have found that you might not have experienced this, Ian, but they are a very, very critical group. Do you have any sense or any theory as to why you think that is?
I don't know why you think I wouldn't have experienced it. I think everybody who's commentated on this game has had a lashing on Twitter or social media because the game is so big, because there are so many followers, and because so many of those followers really are rooting for one team. It's very, very tribal out there. So if I do a game between Liverpool and Manchester United, bitter rivals, I know that I will have dozens of people saying I was biased towards Manchester United from Liverpool, and dozens of people on the other side saying that I was biased towards Liverpool from Manchester. So in the end, it evens itself out. I think you have to take all that criticism and not be too sensitive about it. People are sometimes very nice as well and say good things about your commentary, particularly in the United States. I've noticed that they're a little more appreciative, but you really are. Every time you go on air, I think, in England and call a game, you're probably better off not going onto Twitter and looking at the notifications for a couple of days afterwards.
Could you empathize with Gus Johnson, who was put into the position of trying to learn the sport at the highest level on the fly.
Yeah, I think what Gus did was brave to take that on, really, because if somebody said to me, go out and call NFL next week, I would say no, because I think I'm going to get found out within a matter of seconds. Hmm. I was actually approached at one point very early in my ESPN days to see if I would have a crack at doing some college football, but I said under no circumstances, because I think you've just got to go your limitations. So it's very, very difficult if it's not a sport that you've lived with and is in your soul for the whole of your life to pick it up and sound authentic, because you're broadcasting to an audience who know so much about it.
That's interesting to me. So someone at ESPN approached you to do, like what, like Alabama versus Oklahoma?
Well, no. It never got that far. It was a conversation in a bar in South Africa after the World Cup of 2010.
Wow.
And the idea was sort of floated in my general direction, but it lasted no further than 15 seconds, because I said, look, I would be found out. I'm a soccer announcer, and that's what I am.
This is Ian Dark live from LSU, beautiful Baton Rouge. That would be really interesting. So one of the things when I had previously talked to you, Ian, around the World Cup, you had some remarkable travel experiences in Brazil, just given the weather and given the travel in the country. I'm sure you had other travel experiences throughout your days in covering World Cups and European Championships. I think viewers and listeners always find this interesting. Could you recount some of the more crazy travel experiences that you've had to try to get to a stadium?
Well, the craziest of all, and I think you and I have discussed it before, Richard, was in Recife, or Recife, as the Brazilians called it, USA against Germany, when we awoke to torrential rain and flood water 2 feet deep right throughout the town. The car that was due to pick us up from our seafront hotel never arrived. We tried to hitch a lift with the US team bus, but we're told we weren't security cleared by FIFA, so we couldn't get on that. Luckily, somebody somehow had a contact with the local police chief in Recife, and they sent some vehicle that could get through the floodwater to pick us up and escort us somehow through these floods to the stadium, which was probably 15, 20 miles out of town. I honestly thought 5-6 times during that morning, we're never, ever going to get there for this game. And I can tell you, Casey Keller was due to go off somewhere else and was called back and hauled back from the airport in Rio to get himself into a studio in case we didn't make it. In the end, somehow we did, and the pitch was perfectly playable, and on we went. But that was crazy. The other incident that sticks in my mind in England was a game we did at Stoke one night, Stoke against Port Vale, long ago in the FA Cup. These are local rivals, and it was like being on the on board a fishing trawler or something in the Atlantic. So ferocious was the storm going on. And we were sitting open on the roof calling the game, and all the equipment shorted, and we went through 10 microphones to get that game on air and ended up absolutely soaked to the skin as we wandered like drowned rats downstairs afterwards. But you're always dependent, Richard, when you're on travel. Everybody takes that for granted. How soon before a game do the announcers leave? Because if things go against you, they go against you. It's a miracle to me that everybody does seem to get everywhere on time. And I'm crossing my fingers as I'm saying that.
Yeah, well said. You're right. I mean, rarely do you hear of a broadcaster, certainly at a national level, who doesn't get to a game. Did you... even though you you might have been on vacation, were you able to watch some of the Women's World Cup?
Yeah, I watched a lot of the Women's World Cup, and tremendous success for the United States. I'm so pleased for Jill Ellis, who actually comes from the same city as me in England, Portsmouth. So I've swapped a few stories with her when I've covered the U.S. women's team, which hasn't been often enough, but It was tremendous the way that they managed to peak at exactly the right time. Weren't playing that well going into the tournament, weren't that good in the early stages of it, but really played very, very well, I thought, in the semifinals and finals when it mattered most.
Were you able to watch the Fox coverage, or did you watch it through the UK or another network?
No, I saw it on the BBC in England, so I didn't see Fox's coverage of it, but I only hear good things.
In terms of, that's interesting, that because you're a perfect person to talk to, one of the breakthroughs of that tournament was the English women's team, who finished in third place, obviously a very very rough semifinal for them. But it seems, at least, Ian, in terms of reading about that team from these shores, that there's been a sea change of how the country now looks at women's soccer, and this team may serve as sort of a revolutionary cast in the way the U.S. women's team did in the early 90s, late 80s?
I think it's certainly going to get bigger in England. I don't think it'll ever be as big in England as the U.S. women's team is in America for all kinds of cultural reasons. But the England Lionesses got a lot of publicity. And on the morning, I think, of the semi-final, they even managed to knock the Wimbledon Tennis Championships off the back page. That's never happened before.
Wow. All right, a couple more here. You went to Harlow Technical College, correct?
Yes.
That is a journalist.
I was a journalism student.
That's right. A journalist college in a town called Harlow, which is in Essex, right?
Yeah, which is about 20 miles north of London, and it's not a place you'd choose for a vacation.
All right, I find this fascinating just because this could not happen today. You took specialist journalist courses, you told me once, and when you graduated, I don't know how many, would this have been a four-year school or a two-year school?
Oh, no, it was just 1 year.
Okay, one year.
We did 1 year of solid journalism, and we learned how to write shorthand. We were taught about how journalism and the law were connected. So when we all went into our jobs, we knew that we couldn't libel people and cost right. our organizations millions of pounds worth of money in lawsuits. So it was a good course. It was a good grounding, and it guaranteed us a start in the media world.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a grad school here in the States. What's fascinating, though, is that by going to this school, am I correct, you were guaranteed a job on a newspaper upon graduating?
Yeah, you were then. Of course, that would never happen now.
Right. And so what was the newspaper that, when you graduated, you eventually went to?
I went to a newspaper called the Portsmouth Evening News, which is in Portsmouth on the south coast of England. It was the city where I was born, so I kind of gravitated back to my home city. And it was there that I did my first commentaries, actually, because the hospital radio station, now this is a service provided free to people in hospital, used to do commentary of the local team's matches.
Wow.
So they didn't really have anybody to do it, so they rang the local newspaper and said, have you got anybody there who fancies giving this a chance? So I said, yeah, I'll do it. Something must have been there inside of me. So I went to Fratton Park, which was the home of Portsmouth Football Club, and commentated on all the matches for a whole season. What we found out at the end of the season was, because of a technical fault, nobody'd heard any of it.
That's fantastic. What was the level of football for Portsmouth? Like, what was their division equivalent then?
What you'd call the championship now. They'd be very happy to be in that division at the moment. But, of course, you know, they did have a good time a few seasons ago, won the FA Cup.
Right.
And were in the Premier League until they hit financial trouble.
And when you were on the newspaper, Ian, were you a sports correspondent, or did you cover everything?
I did everything. I used to do news as well, so I would go to city council meetings, I would go to courts. And one of the jobs I had was I had to go to the hospital every morning and check in the accident and emergency unit about people who might have been injured in car accidents and any other rather nasty things that might have gone in the city the night before. And I developed quite a good contact there with all the nurses, because I discovered that they all loved donuts and cream cakes, because they'd never get away with that now. So I used to bring them donuts and cream cakes every morning, and they'd tell me a few things that I wasn't supposed to know.
You, You were a true cops and courts reporter, as we say here in the States.
Did that for a bit. But I kind of was always going to gravitate, I think, towards sport. All my better work was on sport. I just wasn't good enough, I don't think, to be a kind of hard-nosed news scoop reporter.
Did you then move to another newspaper, or did the broadcasting career then come right after that?
I moved briefly to another newspaper in Leicester, in the Midlands of England, a bit further north, and then I got a job on the BBC local radio station there, and that's where I sort of first became a professional broadcaster, rather than doing the hospital broadcast that nobody was listening to.
Gotcha. That's radio. That was Radio Leicester, basically.
Yeah, Radio BBC Radio Leicester, which was the first BBC local radio station in England. So, you're going back there. There are now many, many, many of them, as there are in the USA.
Yeah, that's. I mean, the BBC is a great training ground. And just on a personal, on a personal note, the BBC World Service is my favorite radio network in the world. And I would, in my opinion, they do the best journalism, at least radio-wise, in the world still to this day.
Well, I would never say a word against the BBC. They gave me a fabulous training, first in local radio, then in national radio, and the standards were very, very high when I went to work for the BBC Radio National Sports Room in London, where it was a very hard school, but my goodness me, we had a lot of rough edges knocked off.
Do you still do boxing commentary, Ian, at all?
I don't at the moment, no. I did boxing for many years. In fact, I used to do boxing and football together for many, many years, and the two seem to fit in. But since I've worked for ESPN in America and in BT Sport in England, where they don't really have too much boxing on, there just aren't any fights for me to cover. And my old job was at Sky Sports, where they do still have boxing, but such is the rivalry between Sky and BT Sport that I'm never going to be appearing on Sky anytime soon now.
Do you you did the Holyfield Tyson the second fight, right?
Yeah, I did the ear bite.
The ear bite. Yeah. So I knew you did that. So my question for you is, when you were calling that ringside, did you immediately know that Tyson had bitten Holyfield, and was that part of your call?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it became pretty apparent what had happened. But of course, we couldn't believe it. We were absolutely incredulous. And I can recall afterwards, of course, we were on air with a lot of interviews and stories with Don King and Tyson himself, who was being grilled about, you know, what on earth had he done and what had got into his head to do such a crazy thing. So that was obviously a huge, huge boxing story. But if you want to go even further back, when I was a very, very young radio guy for the BBC, they sent me to the Hagler-Hearns fight in 1985. Wow. And I've never seen a boxing match as memorable or thrilling as that one.
Three rounds of hell, basically. So you were
you were
ringside for that. How, as someone who saw that, could you give the listeners just a sense of just how viscerally violent that those couple rounds were? Because many, many here in the States would say, I mean, that might be the most incredibly violent three-round fight we've ever seen in this country.
Yeah, it was just 8 minutes of mayhem and fury in there. And the background to that fight really was that Thomas the Hitman Hearns had this reputation of being a big, big puncher, but he was moving into Marvin Hagler's middleweight domain. And I think Hagler had become annoyed by the way Hearns was speaking in the build-up to the fight and saying, you know, that I'm the puncher here. And basically, I think he was saying to him, no, you're in my middleweight division now. I'm the bigger guy. You want to have a tear-up? You want to see where the power is? Okay, let's do this thing. And what you got was this incredible tear-up for three rounds. And, of course, Hagler it was who did prevail.
And that was in Vegas, correct?
Yeah, that was in Vegas, open air at Caesar's Palace. The atmosphere there was just incredible, with so many celebrities at ringside. I remember the fight got delayed. Of course, it's the middle of the night, those fights in Las Vegas. It's the middle of the night back in the UK. But because of the delay, a lot of people got up early in the morning and managed to hear it as they were getting ready for breakfast and going out to work. So our audience for that fight was far, far bigger than it would normally have been.
That's pretty great, actually. It's just interesting. I mean, did you ever, as a broadcaster, consciously think about calling fights back when, you know, people would have to get up at 3 and 4 in the morning to watch?
No, not at all. But that's been the story. And it's a great shame, really, because there is a big interest in boxing in the UK. And a lot of British fighters like Lennox Lewis and Ricky Hatton have gone over to the United States to fight. But those have been broadcast at 4:30 a.m. So I think what a lot of people do is they record it and try not to find out the result when they wake up in the morning, which is hard to do these days with Twitter and everything else. And then they watch it as live at 8 a.m. or something.
All right, here are the final three for you, Ian. Where the Men in Blazers duo, who are fabulous guys, Roger and Michael, they've dubbed you Sir Ian Dark. So first off, with the Sir part, was there a ceremony for this, or is this just a verbal tag that they've given you?
I don't know where all this started, but I'm flattered, and I'm hoping the Queen will comply sometime soon and give me my knighthood. No, seriously, and there's a good story with that, actually, because I was doing a piece for ESPN one day on the Sports Center, and Bob Lee told me this, and they'd got a caption ready for when I came on, saying Sir Ian Dark. and it was only the fact that Bob was there on the scene and said, no, he's not really a sir. Take that off. So that nearly went to air. But it's a bit of fun, all that, really. I agree with you. The Men in Blazers guys are great. We had dinner with them out in Rio at the World Cup, they obviously made a big success of that.
They're good lads, and I know they have great fondness for you. What do you expect from Steven Gerrard in the States, Ian?
Well, I've been asked this a few times now. I tell you what I expect, and I expect the same from Frank Lampard. I know he's had a few injury problems since arriving there. These two are just fantastic professionals. They will not shortchange anybody. They will not see this as some kind of retirement present to go and play for decent money in the USA. They will give it their heart and soul, and I think both of them, though obviously they're not as young as they were, but their attitude and professionalism will shine through.
You know, in this country, sports plays a very fascinating role in that it unifies us based on, regardless of our genders and our races. Sometimes it's too much of an obsession for us and can get into some negative things. But overall, I think it brings people together and people love it. You're someone who straddled both England and the U.S. in terms of the sporting cultures. What similarities and or differences do you see in terms of how people react and participate and take part in sports?
It's a difficult question to answer, and I think you're right when you hint there that sometimes we take it all too seriously. When you hear about a world tragedy like the tsunami or something like that, it makes you put it all into perspective. And I think we should remember that it is just sport. These are just games, and I don't like to hear sports commentators and reporters using the word a disastrous performance. No, a disaster was what happened in the tsunami and right. What happened sometimes in these terrible mass shootings that you hear about. So I think it's important we keep perspective. I think the great sports writer in England, Hugh McIlvenny, had a wonderful line about it. He said, sport was magnificent trivia.
That's interesting. Are we going to, God willing, for somebody, are we going to see you in 2018 in Russia calling the World Cup?
I don't know at this point, to be honest with you. So I'd like to think I will be at that World Cup in some capacity.
I will say this. When we let you go off the air, I'll do some negotiating for you with the listeners to try to pump up somebody to grab your services in 2018, because I'm sure the American audience absolutely would like to hear you. All right, Ian Dark joined ESPN in September of 2010 after a very long career at Sky Sports, the BBC. He now works for BT. You have heard him on some of the most iconic soccer/football calls in this country. You can still hear him doing U.S. national team work. And Ian, am I right that that ESPN has the Euros, correct, coming up? Okay.
Yep, next summer we'll be doing every spit and cough of the European Championships, and we hope to do a big and impressive job on that excellent tournament, which will be coming live from France on ESPN next summer.
Excellent. How's your Germany? And because I think you're going to be saying a lot of those names, is my
thing. You fancy them to win again, do you?
I do fancy them to win. At least
Well, maybe you're right. So they're pretty familiar players, and they will certainly start as pretty hot favorites to win, but there may be one or two others who will give them an argument. And the great thing about, I think, football, soccer is it's always evolving. It's always changing, as Spain found out in Brazil.
Definitely. And the French are actually, in all seriousness, the French are going to be fantastic.
Yeah, they should give a good crack of it at home. And, of course, when the last time they were hosts, they won the World Cup in 1998.
All right, Ian, we're going to let you go. It's dinner time where you are in the south of London. Hopefully, since you're back from Spain, maybe some, I don't know, chorizo or some kind of tapas, or back to the English food.
I haven't decided what I'm going to eat tonight, actually, at the moment. So I'll have to give that a thought. Maybe it'll just be an old-fashioned fish and chips or something like that, though I'm told I shouldn't be eating that stuff anymore.
Well, if that is the case, enjoy. All right, Ian Dark has been our guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. We can't thank you enough. Ian, I'm sure I always enjoy talking to you, and I'm sure I will talk to you again soon. Be well.
It's always a pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
Okay, back in the studio to wrap up, our thanks to Sir Ian Dark for coming on the podcast. I can't say enough good things about Ian Dark. He's a fantastic broadcaster. I know a lot of soccer fans can be critical of everybody, and even some are critical of Ian Dark in the States. But generally speaking, this guy has come to our shores and raised the game when it comes to soccer broadcasting, and we are thankful to have him. I know for a fact, in talking to many people at ESPN, he's a good dude. He's a good bloke to hang around with. So he's been a treat for this country. He's had a fascinating career. He's erudite. He's bright. He's fun to talk to. And I appreciate him coming on. All right, I'll bring my producer on, Bet Marston, who, you know, Bet, we will talk. You can answer. You can have any take you want on Ian, but I'm fascinated by the fact that during the podcast, you had peanut butter and jelly yogurt, which I don't think I've even ever heard of. Like, does that, what brand, like, who makes that? That is fascinating.
It's my lunch hour, so I was eating some peanut butter and jelly flavored yogurt that anyone can buy at Trader Joe's across the U.S. Yeah, they're only 99 cents a cup, but it's peanut butter and jelly.
Let's ask Dan Bloom if they're a sponsor. If not, they better be.
My cup of yogurt was quite delicious, and it allowed me to sustain the level of energy that I need to continue while producing this podcast.
Ian Dark level of energy. What do you think of this story? I mean, I knew this story, but the story for him to get to the stadium in Brazil to call that U.S.-Germany game is unreal.
Right, yeah. I heard tales of several different people trying to get to that game. I remember our video producer Lee Feiner was posting videos while he was trying to get there.
I remember that.
And you know, that's kind of how we heard about the newsroom, was we saw Lee tweeting about it and kind of made us all turn heads. But it's you know, even everyone had problems going to that game. Even the net, like, it was, which was just insane. I found it really funny when he told the story about how Bob Lee had to
take the Chiron off.
Yeah. Yeah, no, great. And when he had to get rid of the Sir Ian Dark.
Right, like, right.
It's like people call him that so frequently, but it's...
Would have been great if that got on the air, actually.
I know, and then, that would have gone crazy. And it also, I like that he appreciates that he has started calling soccer when he's in the U.S., and then he gets...
He has to flip between calling soccer in the States and football in the U.K.
Mm-hmm. And then I think he referenced it as football on the podcast a couple of times, which threw me off as the NFL editor here at SI. So
I like that.
I think football all the time, and I was like, wait a second, which football? But
all right, well, listen, Ian Dark was a terrific guest, and we appreciate him coming on. The one thing I'll say as we kick us out, he is calling the European Championships for ESPN, and then I believe his contract's up in 2016. I did not get into it with him on this. I certainly will write about it at a certain point, but he's going to have an interesting decision. Because he probably would want, first of all, I'm sure ESPN wants him to stay. I think he'd probably want to stay at ESPN, but he can't call the World Cup at ESPN because Fox has the World Cup. So, and there's no doubt that Fox would grab him. So he's going to have an interesting decision. ESPN has an interesting decision. The good thing is I think he's going to continue to call games in the States, which I think for all soccer fans and football fans is best of all. All right.
Hey, Deitch.
Yes, Bet.
Question for you.
All right. I was about to go into the close, but
I know,
go ahead.
I cut you off. Since we're sitting here talking about soccer,
right?
Can we get the Men in Blazers to come on the podcast one day?
I will make the ask for them at some point during the EPL season. So let's say like in October and November. And Bet, this is a very good segue. Of future guests who are coming up include Susie Kolber will be coming on this podcast. Fred Gadelli, the producer of Sunday Night Football, most watched show on television, will be coming on this podcast. Mike Hill of Fox Sports 1, previously of ESPN, will be coming on this podcast. Susie Kolber has committed to being on this podcast. I said that already? All right, well, I'm repeating myself. And then finally, Katie Nolan of Fox Sports 1, who you, I think, have wanted on this podcast forever. She has finally committed as well. I believe that's the week of August 24th through the 28th.
That's great. Katie, I'm excited to talk to you if you're listening to this.
I quite frankly, I think part of the reason she's coming on is because of you. I've never seen a PR campaign more. All right. This maybe is the longest outro, and hopefully it will be cut by the time you hear this voice. For producer Bet Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.